All right. Last week, the copier did not print all the handouts that I had typed in for it to print. So there were quite a few people that didn't get this article, and I think more people got the handout on the history of Islam. But I have more of these copied, so if you didn't get one or the other, please make sure you get some of those. I'll pass around the handout first. Okay, if you have already got one, just keep them moving around and take them if you need them. And if you don't, just pass them on. Hopefully they will get around to someone in the back then as well. I believe those are both posted online as well with the teaching series, the sermon series. So if you don't get a paper copy, or if you prefer not to have a paper copy, they are posted there on the church website as well. So today we are talking about Islam, and last week we just kind of scraped the surface because we were running out of time. But this week hopefully we'll be able to dive in and go a little bit deeper. We're going to start with the history of Islam itself, kind of the foundation of Islam with Muhammad, and we're going to look at that. I'm just kind of dragging my feet until everybody gets the handout, and then we'll all be on the same page, literally. The history of Muhammad's life can kind of be broken down into three periods. You have his early life, and Muhammad was born in the Arabian Peninsula, what we would call today Saudi Arabia. And so his early life is lived out there. For a time, he was sent into the desert, which is kind of a tradition amongst Arabs. They send their kids out into the desert. It's kind of the thought of live for a while in the country, and then you won't be tempted by the vices of a city, that sort of thing. So he lived for a while in the desert, tending flocks and taking care of his family's herds. Until he got married, and then he returned to Mecca, which was where his family was originally. And then there's another period of time in his life when he went to Medina. And we'll talk about each of these three periods in more detail. But before I started that, I wanted to put this map up here. So this map kind of shows the Arabian Peninsula kind of in between Asia and Africa and Europe as a crossroads between all those different areas. You might be thinking back to like your middle school history teacher talking about the Silk Road and all the spices that came from the Orient back to Europe various times. So these red and blue lines are the various trade routes that intersected and crisscrossed throughout the Middle East at this time. And you can kind of get a sense for how important this area of the world was as a crossroads of trading routes and things like that. And so that also plays a role in how Islam was developed and how quickly it spread once Muhammad's message was there. So looking at his life a little bit, everything that's in that first paragraph on the handout I pretty much just said in one way or the other. He was born in 570 AD into the Quraysh tribe, and they trace their lineage back to Ishmael and then to Abraham, which will be important later on when we talk a little bit about the way they view the Old Testament or the Old Testament stories that are in the Quran and how they view them. By 595, he was married to a wealthy widow, and that gave him some opportunities to not have to work so hard because he was managing a larger estate at that point, and he could kind of, I don't want to say retire, but it gave him a chance to sit back and turn into a more reflective lifestyle. And so that kind of marks a change in Muhammad's life from working and striving to make a living and getting established and into the time period where he begins to have these revelations or visions. So in 610 AD, Muhammad was, and this is as their story goes, he was meditating in a cave on Mount Hira, and he was overwhelmed by a trance and ordered by a spirit who he later claimed was the angel Gabriel to recite. And that's what the word Quran literally means. The Quran is a series of recitations. Okay? So what Muhammad was supposed to do is simply recite what Allah was revealing to him through the angel Gabriel. And I put in there that he was ordered by a spirit because at first Muhammad didn't know what was happening to him and didn't understand what was happening to him. It wasn't until he returned back to Mecca and people, you know, his family was trying to help him process this experience, what happened to him, that he then attributed this to an angel, because he was kind of worried. You know, there's within the Arab tradition, there's a belief in demons and these creatures called jinn, which we might kind of loosely think of like genies, like magical spirit creatures. And we'll talk more about that kind of stuff later on when we look at Islamic theology. But all of these traditions were kind of in his mind, and he didn't know how to process what happened to him. Eventually, it kind of gets solidified in his mind that this was a revelation from an angel, and he doesn't want to think about it in a negative way. But this trance was not something that he would have described as pleasurable. In fact, when he first described it to his family, it was actually a very traumatic experience. Kind of felt like he was in a vice, is kind of how he describes it, that he was kind of being squeezed. But anyway, so this begins, this is the first of his many recitations as he receives the Quran. Okay, a couple things there about the Quran, and we'll talk about the Quran more later on, but the Quran is only truly the Quran when it's in the original language of the recitation, because any change in the language can change the meaning. So when you talk to a Muslim about the Quran and you reference a book like this, this is Pastor Williams' copy of the Quran. This is a translation of the Quran, and there can be error in the Islamic mind. There could be errors in this because of the English language not being the original language of the revelation of the recitation. Okay, so they could argue with you over semantics and say, well, what that appears to say in the English translation is not what it really says, or not what it's meant to say. And Adam has taken the teens down to Pioneers in Florida, and during that trip, they go to an Islamic school that has a mosque kind of attached to it. And I remember sitting there, and that was one of the arguments that he presented as some of our kids asked questions about the Quran, was that, well, what the Quran says in English, it doesn't really appear the way that it does when you read it in Arabic. And so that's just kind of it rubbed me as a slick sales technique that, you know, what you think it says about violence, that's really not, you can't understand that because it's not in the language that it talks about. So that's just something that I wanted to throw in there as we talk about the Quran and how Muhammad got this revelation. So this basically begins the period of Muhammad's life where he is a prophet, and he sees himself as a prophet to the Arab people, specifically in Mecca, which is the lower of these two points. I can't use my... right in the middle of the Arabian Peninsula. I'm going to get all sorts of feedback, and it's going to start squealing if I stand over there. But it's right in the middle, but it's the lower of the two points. So there's basically two cities right along the southwest border of the Arabian Peninsula. It's the lower of the two. Okay. And basically at this time, the message that he's preaching to the Arabs in that area is that it's one of monotheism. So that people have to give up their polytheistic practices of worshiping many gods. They have to give that up, and they have to submit to God, which is what the words Islam and Muslim actually mean. That's what the roots of those words mean. So Islam means submission to God, and Muslim means those who submit to God. And so they're kind of taking the root of those two words, comes from the same place. And so then after submitting to God, then they... the last part of what he believes is that there will be a day of judgment where everybody is weighed as to how they submitted their lives to God. Okay, and so that's basically the heart of his message at this point in Mecca. And he believes that he will be aided by the Christians and the Jewish people in the area, in the Arabian Peninsula at this time, because they are also monotheistic religions. He thinks that when he starts preaching his message of monotheism to the Arabs, the Jews and the Christians in the area will support him, because he's preaching, in his mind, he thinks it's the same message. And so at this period of his life while he's in Mecca, he's expecting that support, and it ultimately does not come. He never really gets the support that he's looking to, and his attitude towards Jews and Christians then change throughout this time period. So then 622 marks the period of time when he has to leave Mecca because his message has created it's stirred up the people in Mecca, and he's not getting the support that he wants there. So he goes to nearby Medina, or it was originally called Yathrib, but today it's called Medina. So from this point on, I'll just use the word Medina. And that's the northern of the two. And there are more Jews and Christians in Medina. And so he's expecting them to support him in his message there. But what ends up happening is that the Arabs, when they hear Muhammad's message, the Arabs in Medina turn to the Jews and Christians and ask, is this really what the story is about this monotheistic God that he's talking about? Is this really what your Old Testament says? Is this really what your scriptures say? And the Jews and Christians in the area are honest, and they say, no, there are some very serious differences between Muhammad's revealed monotheistic God and the God that we worship. And so this creates more tension then between Muhammad and his group of followers and the Jewish Christian merchants in the city there. A couple examples of some of those differences, just so that I'm not speaking in abstract terms. It says, while the Old Testament views Isaac as the child that God promised to Abraham, the Quran views Ishmael as the rightful heir to Abraham. And that's why it's important that I said at the beginning that Muhammad traces his lineage back to Ishmael, to Abraham, because he's in the Arab world, the firstborn son is very important because that's where the birthright goes. Okay, and so since Ishmael was older, even though Ishmael was born to Hagar, not Sarah, they see Ishmael as the rightful heir. Okay, and so the rightful heir of Abraham's monotheistic beliefs goes to Ishmael, not Isaac. Additionally, while the Quran presents Moses as a prophet of the law, it does not include what a Jewish person may well see as the most important aspect of the Exodus, the Passover. So the Quran does talk about Moses and the Israelites in Egypt, but it doesn't have anything about the Passover or what the Passover means. And a couple weeks ago when we talked about Judaism, we talked about how the Passover story really points to the need for a Messiah, the need that their sins need to be paid for in some way to bridge that gap between God and man. And so that whole part of the Exodus story is left out of the Quran. There are some other things that, as I read, the Quran includes some what Jewish people would think of as apocryphal stories, like legends or maybe even bordering on fairy tales, things that are told, but they're not included in the Jewish Old Testament. They're not included in the Christian Old Testament. And so when they heard Muhammad preaching these stories or telling these stories, they thought, well, that's definitely not true. We don't accept that. And that's exactly what they told the Arab people. And the Arab people in Medina were then kind of, well, Muhammad is saying this, but the Jews and Christians in the area aren't confirming him. And he says they're supposed to confirm him. So they're torn in their mind whether to accept this revelation from Muhammad. And so at this point, when there's this tension, this is when Muhammad's message becomes increasingly militant, and he starts to try to add some more incentives to his message to try to get more Arabs to follow him, to give them some reason to want to do that. So this is kind of down at the bottom of the page. He promised his followers a share of the profits. He started to lead raids on caravans that were traveling through this region. So traveling between Mecca and Medina, specifically going to or from Mecca, because that was where he was rejected. So kind of as punishment against Mecca, he was going to lead raids on these trade caravans that were going through there. But this is when he begins to offer the incentive that a share of the plunder from the attacks on those trade caravans would go to his followers, specifically women and girls that were traveling with the caravans. And we don't need to get too graphic there about why that would be an incentive to men that are doing bad things, but we'll leave it at that. At the end of this handout, there is a list of verses of violence. Okay, so if you ever wanted to look up various verses in the Quran that reference violence, just to look to see for yourself if the Quran really preaches violence or talks about violence. That list is there. I considered doing it, but for a more thorough look at this, you could read the book Secrets of the Quran by Don Richardson. This is in our library. He also looks at the Quran's view of women and the way women are portrayed in the Quran. So that would be another interesting. There's not as many verses that deal with women in the Quran, but that would be another kind of interesting. If you want to learn more about what the Quran actually says, you could kind of look those things up and look at it for yourself. But during this time of Muhammad's life, he's enticing more men to follow him. And with this enticement of a share of the plunder from these attacks on the trade caravans and a share of the women that are captured from that, he raises his numbers to around 10,000 men. And he decides that's a large enough force to go back to Mecca and take the city of Mecca. And the reason Mecca is important to him is that in his view, Mecca is the location that Ishmael and Abraham started their monotheistic beliefs at. Okay, so in his mind, Mecca is the location where, and this keeps with Arab tradition, that Mecca is the location of the spring that saved Ishmael and Hagar in the desert whenever they were dying of thirst. And so Mecca is important for that reason. But then Mecca became corrupted by all the other polytheistic practices in the Arab world. And so Muhammad is seeing his job as cleansing Mecca of all this polytheism, and he's going to throw out all the shrines and the idol worship and rededicate Mecca to Allah. Okay, so that's what he does. He takes this army of 10,000 men, goes back to Mecca, and cleanses the town of all these polytheistic practices. The Kaaba was a shrine that was originally built in the Arab mind to Allah. And then it was also corrupted by polytheism. So he cleansed this shrine, and this now becomes the place that that Muslims are supposed to pray to five times a day. Originally, when Muhammad first received his recitation, his revelation, he said Jerusalem was the place that they should pray to. And this was at the time when he was hoping that the Jews and the Christians would verify his message and get on board with him. After he realized that the Jews and Christians weren't going to verify his message, then he changed the location to Mecca and told people that they have to pray to Mecca five times a day. Specifically, this one shrine in Mecca, the Kaaba, is supposed to be where they pray to. And there's other things. You could read up more about that. There's a black rock that supposedly fell from heaven and was, I think it came from one of the archangels. You could read more about that if you're interested in that. But that's all. That's in the Kaaba, and they don't pray to that, but it's there. It's venerated, I guess, in some way. The Kaaba is also, Mecca is also where Muslims are supposed to make pilgrimage at some point in their life. So they're supposed to go to Mecca at some point in their life, and you might have seen pictures of a little box with crowds of thousands of people walking in circles around it. That's part of the pilgrimage, and that box is the Kaaba, and that's what they're doing. That's part of their pilgrimage. So they march in circles around that, and that's part of what they're supposed to do. Okay. So before we move on to talking about types of Islam, does anybody have questions about Muhammad and his life? Any parts of that story? Okay. So then after Muhammad's death, that's when we start to get splits and fissures within the Muslim world. So after his death, the most pressing issue for his followers was who should become their next leader. Muhammad's heir would be the easiest choice, but Muhammad had only had daughters. So his closest male relatives were either his son-in-law or his father-in-law, and their names were Ali and Abu Bakr. So those two men become the two that are vying for the rightful leadership of this army of followers that Muhammad had raised. Okay. And additionally, Arab tradition holds that the leader of a tribe should be elected by consensus or sunnah. Now, last week we talked briefly about the things that the Muslim world looks at as their revelation or where they get answers from. And we said that those are the Quran, the Hadith, and the Sunnah. That those three things in their mind kind of spell out the way their life is supposed to be lived. And so this word sunnah is translated in multiple different ways. One of the translations can be census or consensus, that the idea of the way that an Arab tribe is supposed to make their decisions is by vote. Okay, so there's a vote held amongst the elders of their tribe, and however they deem to be the most wise way to go, that's where they go. And so this word sunnah can also mean a path. Okay, so it can also refer to a path that you walk on, and the way you find that path is by seeking wise counsel, and the most wise counsel, whichever direction they point you in, that's the sunnah. Okay. Now, as this is applied to Muhammad, the path that he walked is his sunnah, and that's an example for the Islamic world to follow. Okay. All that said, because the word sunnah is where the largest group of Muslims get their name, the Sunni Muslims, they draw their name and their style of Islamic practice from this consensus that then voted that the father-in-law, Abu Bakr, would be the rightful successor to Muhammad. So he then became the first khalifa. You might have heard that term thrown around and you wondered what is a khalifa? So a caliph or a khalifa is a civil and religious leader. Okay, so within the Sunni tradition, there were four rightly guided khalifas. Okay, so there was a succession of four civil and religious leaders that guided the Islamic world along a right path. And that's the time period where we see Islam really exploding and spreading throughout the Middle East, mainly driven by intimidation and the sword. This is also where Parveen was looking through the missionary handout. Was that in today's bulletin? Last week's bulletin. And it made reference to a deal that Christians and Jews could make with the... You might have read recently that ISIS is claiming that they're setting up a new caliphate, okay? So the caliphate is the land that is led by the khalifa, okay? So ISIS is Sunni, although some liberal Sunnis might not want to associate with ISIS. ISIS identifies themselves as Sunni. So they're claiming that they are reestablishing the caliphate, the land governed by the khalifa. And one of the deals that these early khalifas made was that Jews and Christians could live under the caliphate, but they had to be in submission to the Islamic government, and they had to pay a special tax in order to live in peace. And then, as Doran said, there were still times whenever the Muslims looked over at the Jews and Christians and said, hey, they're making out pretty well. Why is it that we're living in poverty over here, but they're successful over there? Let's go throw those Christians down or throw those Jewish people down, and we'll show them for being so prosperous under our leadership. So there's still that tension. Just because you're paying this tax doesn't mean that you're free from all persecution and violence within that system. But that's the time period when that deal was originally referred to, and since ISIS is trying to reestablish this and they're trying to refer back to this, that's kind of the deal that they're making today as well. You can see there, this is also where the term Sharia law comes from, is from the Sunni tradition. So this idea of the elders voting and making a consensus of what is the right way, that's where the idea of Sharia law comes from. So if you've heard that and you've wondered, well, what does that mean? That's just the law that comes from the Sunni tradition, is this is the way, from studying the Quran, the Hadith, and looking at Muhammad's life, that we can say these are the laws that should govern a society that's trying to stick to the Quran and the Hadith. The Hadith is the kind of traditions of other people that knew Muhammad. So those things all added together kind of is where they get the idea of Sharia law from. One other thing to add there, you can see in the box or the paragraph there under the Sunnis, that's 85% of the Muslim world. So the majority of the Muslim world considers themselves Sunni Muslims. But a country that is governed by Sharia law is a complex country. So when we think of like Iran and you hear about Iran trying to negotiate deals with President Obama, and then there's these side deals going on with the UN, and there's all these deals being made, and you're trying to understand what does this mean. It's very complex to try to understand what it means, because in Iran, there's many leaders that don't have clearly defined spheres of authority. Okay, so you might be a religious leader, but then you might also be a civil leader, And so those are kind of overlapping spheres. Or you might just be a civil leader. You have a political role. So you have some authority over the politics of Iran, but you don't have any religious authority then. Or you might just be an imam or someone who's a religious teacher. You don't necessarily have any sure political authority, but what you say about your religion is going to affect the way that people interpret the law. So there's all these various levels and overlapping spheres of authority. It makes it very difficult to try to understand how a nation like or a country like Iran is really run, how it's really how it really operates. So it's very complex to try to understand Iran. Just leave it at that. The second group then are the Shias or Shiites. You might have heard them referred to. They make up about 15% of the Muslim world, and so they're the minority group. But countries like there are some found in Iran, Iraq, Lebanon, Yemen, Afghanistan, Pakistan, but they're not necessarily in a majority in those locations. So they may still be persecuted just because they live in those countries. But the Shias are the ones that follow. They believe that Ali was the rightful heir to Muhammad. So they followed him as their leader. They called Ali the first of the great imams. And imam is just a word that means teacher. Okay, so he was a great teacher or leader. And he then began a time when they say that there were 12 original great imams that taught them the correct way to practice Islam. Okay, so the Sunnis have their four caliphs and the Shias have 12 imams. And this is really where their differences are, in that the Sunnis believe that the caliphs were going to rule by consensus. They were going to, like, take a democratic vote, and that's how decisions would be made. The imams, though, they have some connection with Allah, and they're receiving revelation from Allah as to what is the right way to practice Islam. So the Shias, or the Shiites, they attribute infallibility, sinlessness, and the divine right of authority to their imams, their leaders. Because there were only 12 imams, they don't use the word imam loosely. Okay, like an imam in a Sunni country might just be any teacher. Or you might hear in England or even in America today, a teacher at a mosque being called an imam, okay? But a Shia Muslim wouldn't throw that word around loosely, because to them there were only 12 imams. The last of those 12 imams was taken up to heaven without being killed, and he will return on the day of judgment. That's how serious and how special, separate they view these imams. So in order to give authority to someone, they came up with the title Ayatollah. You might have heard of the term Ayatollah before. Okay, so the term Ayatollah then is the closest thing to an imam that the Shia world has. So the Ayatollah is claiming to be the rightful heir to that legacy of the imams, and that, so that he's the leader within the Shia tradition. So that's the Sunni and the Shias. That's the two main divisions in Islam today. The third group are the Sufi Muslims. And what they're probably most well known for is this dance called a whirling dervish. They're not actually a separate group of Muslims. You can be a Sufi Sunni Muslim or a Sufi Shia Muslim, but all it really means is that the Sufi tradition is one that's more mystical. There's more mysticism tied up in the way they connect with Allah. And this dance is part of that. They're famous for, you know, people go and watch these dances like it's a concert or something. But there's chanting and they're spinning around in circles and they wear these robes that I guess they look neat whenever they're all dancing around the dance floor. But this is, they believe, a way to connect with Allah. So this is like their practice of worship. Has nothing really to do with what the Quran says or the Hadith says or any of those other religious teachings. This is just, they believe, a mystical way to connect with Allah. So you can read more about the Sufis there if you'd like. And then one other group of Muslims today, which most of the other groups of Muslims maybe not wouldn't consider Muslim, would be tribal syncretism. Just like we talked with Roman Catholicism, as Roman Catholicism spread around the world, tribal groups accepted Roman Catholicism in some level, but they kept all of their other animistic beliefs. There are some tribes around the world today that have accepted Islam simply because that's the only way they could have survived, because they were being told to convert at sword point. And so they accepted it, they converted, but they added that in with all the other tribal animistic beliefs that they had before. So it's this kind of syncretistic Islam that David. Yeah. In various times, the Sufis have not been accepted by the Sunnis or the Shias, so they may view themselves as a little bit of an outsider group, and maybe that's why they don't want to persecute other groups as much as maybe the Sunnis would. That's kind of interesting. Pardon me? Yeah. I don't know where the original Sufi groups came from. I'm thinking like that Slavic region that's kind of right between Russia and like Albania, Georgia, that area of the Middle East. It's right between the Middle East and Russia. There's kind of that band where, you know, Kazakhstan and all those other areas are that are also mainly Muslim countries, but that may have been where some of the clothing items came from. Okay, so Islamic beliefs, we'll get into some of those things. So the big thing for Islam is that it's all about Allah alone, okay? And Allah actually is the Arabic word for God. So missionaries to a Muslim country, they have a difficult decision to make. Because in the Arab mindset, you know, we talked about worldview being shaped by the language that you learn through, okay? And so the way you understand God is through the word God. You have a concept in your mind that's linked with that. Well, in the Arab mindset, all of those concepts are linked to the word Allah, okay? So how do you witness to someone about God without calling him Allah? Or do you make the decision to go ahead and call him Allah? That's kind of a decision I've heard missionaries give that presentation, that in their witnessing, they got to make that decision. Do we use the word Allah, or do we stay away from that and come up with another name for God? But then that is also kind of a stumbling block, because an Arab person might say, well, you're calling him something else. Is he the same God as what I'm used to? Well, there are differences between the Arab concept of Allah and our concept of God. So maybe you don't want to use the same name, or maybe you do. So that's a difficult decision to make. And since I'm not in a Islamic country, I'm not going to try to presume that I know more than they do. But in the Islamic world, Allah is greater than all creation. He's gracious and merciful. Allah predestines all things, so that nothing ever happens that isn't part of Allah's plan. And Allah is not personal or relational. Okay, so that's the key difference. And that what I would see as a stumbling block between trying to use the name Allah as you're trying to teach who God is, that the Judeo-Christian version of God or teachings about God, he's definitely personal and relational, and that's all about, you know, the message that we're trying to get out about Jesus, is that the Islamic world would not see what Jesus does as any part of what Allah is, because he's not personal or relational. Okay, Allah has revealed his will through a series of prophets, Moses being one of them, David being one of them, Jesus being one of them. The problem is that Islam sees all of those other prophets, their messages have been corrupted by people. Okay, so Muhammad being the last of the prophets is the only message that hasn't been corrupted or that isn't corrupt. And that is because of the nature of the recitations of the Quran. Muhammad couldn't add to or subtract from anything that he was told to recite. He just had to recite it and put it down exactly as God or as Allah was telling him. So that's the way they view prophets. So you might have heard that, you know, the Quran does talk about Jesus. It does talk about Moses. And so there's some common ground then where you can talk to a Muslim person about Jesus to some extent. But the Quran doesn't say the same things about Jesus that our Bible says about Jesus. So don't assume that they're gonna line up. But if you have an opportunity to talk with a Muslim person and they're open to comparing and contrasting the Quran with the Bible, that could be an interesting conversation that you could have. They view the Quran as the word of Allah. It is presented as a series of recitations and is consequently repetitive. However, the surahs and surahs are chapters and ayahs are verses. They're not completely agreed upon. So depending on what translation of the Quran you have, the numbers that help you find your way around it might be different. So that gets a little frustrating, that different translations put the chapters and verses in slightly different places. But it's usually not radically different. They're not that far apart. So if you're looking for a verse that talks about jihad and you look it up and that verse has nothing to do about jihad, look a couple verses on either side of it and you'll probably find it. But to understand how the Quran is structured, you must think of it as a literal book. So this is how the Islamic world thinks about the Quran and the way that Muhammad was revealed it. So they think about it as if the Quran was literally written in heaven, okay, with Allah, and Muhammad was just shown portions of it upon each recitation. Okay, so picture Muhammad being invited to look into this book at the first time where he was overcome by the spirit on the mountain, and the spirit showed him, opened up the book and showed him a part of the book. And Muhammad was then supposed to recite this part of the book so that it would be known and passed on. Okay. Might not have started on the first page of the book, though. Okay, so the first revelation or recitation that Muhammad had isn't at the beginning of the Quran. Okay, so then with each further recitation or revelation, the different parts of the book got filled in. That's how the Islamic world sees that. And of course, an outside person might say, well, that's just evidence that Muhammad is going and contradicting what he said, and he's just saying that something else comes first after the fact, so that you have to interpret what he said first in a different way. So he's adding more things to the beginning of the book to change what it meant at the end. So that could probably be a long conversation there as well with an Islamic person trying to come to a meeting of the minds on that. Okay, another element of that is that there were approximately 90 chapters written before Muhammad made this journey from Mecca to Medina the first time. You'll remember when he was originally in Mecca, he was friendly towards the Jews and Christians in the area because he wanted them to support his monotheism. And then after he left Mecca the first time and went to Medina, that's when his view towards the Jews and Christians got a little less friendly. The 90 chapters that were written first are sometimes referred to as the Meccan chapters, okay? And they tend to be less violent in their teaching. The ones that were written later while he was in Medina, while he was trying to attract Arab followers to attack the caravans and stuff, those are the ones that have more about violence and about jihad in them. Now, that being said, that doesn't mean that the original 90 verse books aren't violent at all. They do also talk about jihad to some extent. Okay, we're running out of time, so I'll skip over a little bit more. Just pointing out, so the Quran, the Hadith is the next thing that a Muslim person looks to show them what their life should be governed by. It's a collection of traditions and teachings gathered by the followers of Muhammad. Okay, so these are the men that originally were attracted to Muhammad, and they are then reporting what they saw in Muhammad's life. That's what the Hadith is. It's kind of their recollection of the way that the Prophet lived his life. Okay? And within the Hadith, then, you see how Muhammad lived his life, which would be the path that he walked on, which is what the Sunnah refers to again. Remember I said the Sunnah can be translated as consensus. It's also the path that you're supposed to walk on. So within the Arab tradition, you seek counsel, whatever the most people counsel you in, that's the path that you're supposed to take. That's the Sunnah, so you can see Muhammad's Sunnah, his way, spelled out in the Hadith. The Quran, then, is the revelation from Allah. So those three things together, sometimes Hadith and Sunnah are referred to interchangeably, but those are the things that an Islamic person looks to. Almost completely out of time. One other thing I wanted to talk about are the five pillars of Islam that you might have heard about before. This is usually what gets presented in like a secular class about Islam and what do they believe. The first is to bear witness, which is the Shahada, and that is there is no God but God, or there is no God but Allah, since God is the Arabic word for Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. This is to be stated with conviction, and a Christian should not say this for any reason, even without conviction, within a Muslim country. Okay, the more serious that the country identifies themselves as Muslim, the less you should say that. It would be okay. I mean, in this, I don't think that makes me a Muslim. I don't believe that. But in an Islamic country, simply saying that could be viewed as making you a Muslim. Okay, and you might think, well, that means they can't kill you. No, because if you're a Muslim who doesn't live according to Muslim law, you can be killed as well. So just don't say that. The next of the five pillars is to pray. And this is supposed to be, it's prescribed as five times a day, sunrise, noon, mid-afternoon, sunset, and before bedtime. And at noon on Friday, they all gather at the local mosque. You might have heard of the call to prayer going out over loudspeakers, and that's on Friday when they all gather to pray in groups. The third pillar then is to give alms. It's prescribed as 1/40 of your wealth is supposed to be given to take care of the poor, the orphans and widows and all of that. The fourth one is to fast, and this is mostly done during the month of Ramadan. It is also like the Jewish calendar. It's a lunar calendar, so it doesn't line up exactly with our calendar. So Ramadan floats around during the year. But that is a month of fast where they fast from sunup to sundown, and then they break fast at the end of the day. And that is to commemorate Muhammad's reception of the Quran. So while they're fasting during the day, they're supposed to be thinking about how special the Quran is as a revelation to Muhammad. The last of the five pillars is to make pilgrimage. Like I said, they're supposed to go to Mecca and visit the Kaaba. And the sixth one, which sometimes doesn't get included, is to struggle, which is what the word jihad means. And so Muhammad referred to greater and lesser jihad. The greater jihad is the jihad that everybody is supposed to do all the time as they struggle within themselves to submit their will to Allah. The lesser jihad is the physical violence, the fighting against those who dishonor Allah. So I will let you read that and maybe read the article as well for next week and think about. Adam assured me that we'll have a little bit of time next week. So then we'll talk about the Islamic worldview picture that's on the bottom of that page next week. We're almost out of, we are out of time, so. I'll just close in prayer real quickly here. Dear Heavenly Father, we just thank you for this time to gather together. I pray that it was useful in some way. Lord, I pray that if I misspoke, that you would just allow people to have understood. And God, just guide them in understanding this religion that is in the forefront of our world events, Lord. But also just help us to have a heart that is willing to reach out to people no matter what, no matter how afraid we might be about what they believe or about how we think we might be heard or interpreted, Lord. Just give us a heart of courage to reach out to them with the gospel and to be able to strike up conversations with people that we run into, whether they are Muslim or whatever else they believe, Lord. Just give us that courage, Lord. And as we turn towards the worship service, Lord, just help us to keep our eyes focused on you. Help us to just worship you with all our hearts. And Lord, we just thank you for the opportunity to do that. And we ask all this in your name. Amen.